Adar is the yard site of one of the most unusual Gedolim class I've ever had, and that's the Chidor. First of all, like always, where did I get my information from? The best, we'll see in a second that there's actually a Welt of first-hand information, but the best place, the best thing written on the Chidor is something called Sefer Chidor from, or it's called a Chidor, from somebody named there, it's called Meir ben Ayahu. Meir ben Ayahu was a son of the chief rabbi of Nissim, of Rabbi Yitzchak Nissim. He was a Yodea Sefer, big Yodea Sefer. He was a big researcher, and the stuff that he's written in many things is very reliable. I mean, it's research stuff, and it's everything is noted, and so on. So it's something which is extremely reliable, and he has all the Mekoiros. So it's basically an extremely good work. We'll see soon that it doesn't take all that much to write on the Chidor. You don't need much Mekoiros, but we'll give a sketch about his life, and then we'll go through more details. Chidor was born in Yerushalayim in 1721, and he started writing. He was a prodigy. He started writing Sfarim at the age of 16, 17. He went to Hebron, to live in Hebron. And in those days, he was sent as a shliach from Eretz Yisrael in 1753, was his first shlichus, for 5 years to go collect money in Europe for Eretz Yisrael. This is a very, very important part of his life, and we'll talk about it later also. He spent 5 years. Then he came back to Eretz Yisrael in 1758. In 1764, there was a lot of politics in Yerushalayim. There was a vad of wealthy Jews in Turkey who supported a lot of Yerushalayim moistis. In 1720, most of the moistis in Yerushalayim had bankrupted. The Ashkenazi ones first, and the Sephardi ones were really breaking. And a group of wealthy Turkish Jews got together, and they founded a vad pekidei Eretz Yisrael, that they would send money to Eretz Yisrael. Turkey was the big country at the time. The Ottoman Empire was the one that ruled over Eretz Yisrael. And they would support most of the moistis. When you support the moistis, you want to make sure that they run, you know, with certain, let's put it this way, financial stability and accountability and so on. So they had people, pekidim, that they sent to Eretz Yisrael to take care that it's running well. These people, the wealthy people in Turkey, also acted as go-betweens to the Turkish government. Turkish government was a pretty benighted, despotic group of people. The Sultan was interested in money and soaking people for money, and they would always try to tax people. And these people were wealthy, they had clout, so they would also act on behalf of that Sultan Eden to get the Turkish government to be a little more reasonable. One of the people they sent to Yerushalayim was somebody that the people of Yerushalayim felt was arrogant, haughty, bossy, terrible. They really, really didn't like it, and they tried to get him removed. And they sent the Chidor, a group of people, to try to make Ishtadlus. He went through Mitzrayim, and then they realized that he has too many powerful friends in Turkey. He couldn't go to Turkey, he couldn't come back to Eretz Yisrael. So he was stuck in Mitzrayim for a bunch of years. He then, a few years later, when he was able to come back, he came back to Hebron, to come back to Yerushalayim. And then he went out again in 1773 for Shlichus to Tunis, to Tunisia, and then again to Europe, all over Europe. In 1778, he settled in a town, in Livorno, a big town, city in Italy. And he remained there till he died. Why he didn't come back to Israel is not clear. Nobody knows why. He didn't have an official position in Livorno, but he just he sat and wrote a tremendous amount, as he did all his life. Tremendous writer. And until he was nifta, he wrote that he wants to come back to Israel. He very much wants to come back. Never was able to come back. And he was nifted in 1806 in Livorno in Italy, on Yud Aleph Adar. The just to give a sense of the tkufa, 1760, which is kind of the mid-year of the Chida's life, so the Chida was in the middle of his life, at that time, the people, the Gdolim living in Klal Yisrael at that time were the Gra, the Baal Shem Tov died in 1760 possibly, the Choizim Lublin or the Yitzhak Baditchev, the Ktsois, the Reb Chaim Volozhin, those were people that were his contemporaries. The Rital Ghazi was a chava of his. Those were some of the, and the Rashash, not the one in the Gemara, but the big Mekubal. Those were all people that could have been contemporaries at the time. That's the Chida's life, the sketch of his lifespan. Let's speak about a few of the inyanim that are very relevant, and let's explain some of the things that he left. He wrote. He was a prolific writer. It's hard to keep track of how many sfarim. They range. The estimates range from 60 to 80 to 130, 140. Part of it is we have a lot of kisiyadis. We do have in yeshiva. There's a set of chidas sfarim, which the problem is some of the sfarim are two volumes. Some of the sfarim are in different inyanim. It's hard to know how to count them as different sfarim. But there's kamat not a miktsaya in Torah that he didn't write on. He was an extraordinary prolific writer. There's a place where he writes in an entry in his diary that I was very, very sick this day. I was so weak and so sick that I couldn't learn, I couldn't even daven. And I just grabbed a small sefer and I wrote Haggos and Horus on it. He also writes about some things that he said he wrote while he was sleeping, and he woke up and didn't like at all what he was mechadish, and he crossed it out and so on. He was an extraordinary prolific writer. He left over two of his firm are unique, probably in the history of Klal Yisrael, and those are the ones I want to focus on. One of them is called Shema Gdolim. Shema Gdolim is a double sefer. It has the names of about 1,300 Gedolim, and that they lived, and biographical notes about them, and about an equal amount. The second half is called is the Shema Sfarim. It has about 1,200-1,300 Sfarim that were written up to his time, and sketches about it. It's an incredible. It's a small sefer. It's one of the most valuable Sfarim we have. First of all, he traveled, like we said before, he spent 10 years traveling in Europe. Every single place that he traveled to, the first thing he asked was, before he asked for money, he asked for kisviyadis. If anybody has any sfarim, he had an amazing memory in tfisa, and he would take hold of whatever he read, and he would remember it, and he would write notes about all the kisviyadis he found, all the rishonim, everything that he tracked down. He had the eye of a researcher. In other words, if sefer A brought sefer B down, obviously sefer A is later than B, and then so how could something else write somewhere else from this person and not from that person? And he really, it's an amazing, amazing amount of research that he did. He had the eye for being able to distinguish between, and he put together the best, the most solid history that we have of a few hundred years worth of people and Sfarim is his. It's incredible, incredible work. What's amazing about it is he wrote very short. It wasn't Meirich. But he wrote like the most essential parts. This in the Sefer must have been written. When did he write the Kesef Mishnah? Write it before the Beis or after? He says it has to be after, because in this place he quotes this, in this place he doesn't quote this, in this place he's brought here. That type of thing he writes very bekitzer. He also, what's incredible about the Sefer is he was a researcher and a mekubal together. So he'll write about the Beis Yosef, and he'll write who must have been his rebbes and where we find shuvas for somebody else for somewhere else, and so he must have been this place, that place, the other place. And then he'll write in small oisias And the Arizal says that he was a Gilgal of this and this neshama, and that's why he was Zeichet Eliyahu HaNavi, like it says in this and this place in the Zohar. The mixture of the kind of very, very real and, you know, kind of research stuff together with other things is incredible. It's incredible work. The basis for most of the things we have today comes from him. He also has Kisa Yadis that he wrote about, and there's almost no library in Europe of significance that doesn't have Kisa Yadis with his notations on it and remarks, and he writes about it. I found this place, Xavier Altman, this person wasn't published yet. This, I was found this, that, the other thing. He occasionally was, you could see occasionally sort of wanted to, he was upset with Rabbi Yaakov Emdin, that Rabbi Yaakov Emdin did not, he wrote about the Zohar, that parts of it were not from Shem Yichoy, and he writes that it was just a kanoz against Shapsi Tzvi, and so on. It's a sefer that is, it's a small sefer, and it's a type of thing that today they would have a whole machon researching. It's incredible. It's incredible work, and it's the basis for a lot of what we know. Basically, anything that says in the sefer is history. You can trust it. He doesn't bring any mises, doesn't bring any bubba mises. Anything that he writes, he'll write exactly where he found it, where he saw it. And occasionally when he writes something, mipi hashmua, he'll write that I heard this from someone very, very reliable, and I believe the story, and so on and so forth. A very, very incredible work. That's Hashem HaGdolim. And he writes much about the Rambam, Kabbalah, all important things. And again, in a tshuva safe, he'll bring down a tshuva safe and he'll pick two or three points that he says that are especially worth noting, and so on. The other sefer that he wrote, and Shem HaGdolim is a very common sefer, it's a sefer, it's a must in everybody's library, it's a sefer that's it's very, very widely published. The other sefer was published once, it's called Ma'agal Toiv. And it's an unusual sefer, it's his own diary of all of his wanderings, his travels. It's incredibly candid, it's extraordinary sefer, and it was published once in the 30s, there are copies of it obviously, and it's there are two versions. There was a shorter one, it was only first Nesiyah, and then the full version one has both Nesiyahs. It's an incredible source of information for so many things, things that I just will try to point out just to give a sense of the person. He wrote very open with names and facts, good things that happened to him, bad things that happened to him, good people that he met, bad people that he met, Goyim, Yidden, everything. Very incredible. It's interesting to understand why he wrote it. I don't think he published it, Bechayev, but we have it. His other Sfarim are in almost every Mikzaya. One of the things that he specialized in, Halacha, his most famous sefer, most chashuv sefer, is called Birkas Yosef. It's on Shulchan Aruch, and it's valuable additions to the Shulchan Aruch. Big sefer, big, it's two halakim, I think, and he writes on everything and anything. His Sfarim and everything else, his resources of quoting stuff is incredible. He has drushes that he said, and the drushes, he all starts like with a story, and the story has a moral. He could be a folk starshin, he could be a mekubal, a researcher. His versatility was incredible. I want to focus obviously more a little bit on the Nesiyahs and the Ma'agal Tov. That's where it's the most interesting historic material. That's why I said Benayahu did not have to do much work, just simply sifting through what he wrote. Is there's one problem with reading his things, and that's kedai to note. He was Moli V'Gadish with Tanakh and Medrashim and everything else. He writes a very, very very allegorical Hebrew. It's like he's always writing double jokes, Rimazim, Psukim, half Psukim. So you to know what he said, you have to be able to know what he means over here. He very much would describe something in certain words and then write and then sort of write it Beremiza and Psukim and Rashi Tevis. That was his style. So in Shem HaGdolim, it's very, very matter of fact, very clear, crystal clear. Ma'agal Tov, it's extremely flowery, and you have to figure out what he's trying to say a lot of times. I'd like to go through some of the fascinating things. The first thing was, in a bigger context, there was a huge problem that seemed to exist from the early history down. Eretz Yisrael was never self-sufficient. And Eretz Yisrael always depended on support from the outside. There's a two-volume work here, a researched work called Shluch Eretz Yisrael by Aleph Yari, where he goes through all the documents of Shluchim Eretz Yisrael. The people would go from Eretz Yisrael to collect in Europe. It created a lot of problems and a lot of tensions, and let's go through some of them. The people coming from Eretz Yisrael in those days, it was a big thing. A shliach coming from Eretz Yisrael representing the yishuv. If the people were coarse, not talmid chachamim, or any other problems, people would say, oh, this is what the people of Eretz Yisrael are like. And it would make a very, very bad taste. Sometimes these people were very aggressive in fundraising. People resented it. People also did not take kindly to the fact that every community had its own institutions, its own needs, and these people coming from Eretz Yisrael were taken away from that. And there was a constant battle of whether or not I need Eretz Yisrael, I didn't have any erich or not. And this was a sore point, especially in communities that were poor, and they couldn't afford to send out money, and they felt they were taken away from them. This is the whole hundreds and hundreds of years of the same problems. There was one more terrible problem, which today in that way is some ways it's better, some ways not. The shluchim from Eretz Yisrael, today Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a gift of Google, and as soon as somebody comes to your door, you pull out the smartphone, you take a look at his tuda, you click it with the smartphone, and you immediately know everything about the person, his bank account, and what he's been arrested for, and so on and so forth. In those days, somebody would appear dressed in Sephardi garb, looking like very, very neat, right? And saying he's the great Goyen, the Chacham of Yerushalayim and Sfas together, and he's collecting money and this and that. And everybody would give him Kavod Malachim, and he would give brachas, and that's it. 2 weeks later, a letter would come from Yerushalayim that if anybody is collecting for Yerushalayim and poses the Chacham, he's a big fake, and he's a liar and a cheat, and so on and so forth. There was no way to know. So people would have letters with a lot of chasimis that this person had, but in order to how do you know the letters are genuine? And it was not a simple issue. And people got, you get burnt once or twice, and that's the end of it. There was another issue. Even the people that wanted to give to people in Eretz Yisrael, they wanted to give to people from their country. So everyone had a kolo. Hungary had Hungarian kolo, which meant people from Hungary were supported by people from Hungary. They did not want to support people from Tunisia. They wanted to support their people. Those were issues in Shluchim Eretz Yisrael. The Chiduf faced many of those issues. And he writes, in each place, he went to hundreds and hundreds of towns and writes each one. And he writes, in this place, there were Calvary, Bekovet, Godel, and Israel, this and that. The worst country, the one where he got very cold reception, people just left him standing outside to freeze in the cold, basically, they didn't offer him a place to sleep, was Germany. German Jews, for some reason, not really like him. And they gave him a very cold shoulder. In one place he writes, and he writes very angrily, he said, my kavod I can be mevata, but the kavod of Shluch Eretz Yisrael, I can't be mevata. In one place, he had one credential that nobody could claim was a forgery. He was in a town, and whatever, the Rav gave him a very cold reception, and then I think the Rav called in maybe his son-in-law or a friend of his, and the Chidah, it was Shabbos afternoon, and the Chidah started talking to him and learning, and for 6 hours, he writes, they were going back and forth on Inyan, and at the end, Nochadaitoi, that this person, whatever he is, he's definitely a big Talmud Chacham. And they begrudgingly were okay with the Chidah, but then they said, we have a takana that we don't give money outside, they gave him more money and so on. But this was, the travel in those days was horrendous. And every step of the way was dangerous. He writes, he had to go to Hebron. He left Yerushalayim. And for those of you who've been there to Israel, if you know where Telstone is, next to Telstone, there's an Arab village called Abu Ghosh. So by car, it's 10 minutes outside Yerushalayim, maybe 15, maybe. And Abba Gush is a sleepy Arab town. It's the Baruch Hashem, no problems with it. Abba Gush used to have very nasty robbers living there. And the Chidor writes that they were traveling, and Vahanocha Shagodl from Abba Gush came with 250 of his people to basically loot them and kill them, whatever it is. So the Chidor writes, I used two very special Shemus HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Baruch Hashem, he said, they left me alone with 100 zlotas. I was able to buy them off, and that was like very cheap, and it was a nes nigla. That's how he writes about it. And then wherever he went, you know, he went to Aza. Aza was a Jew, and there were Jews living there and so on, but on the way they were attacked. Wherever you traveled, you were constantly in danger. It's incredible what it meant in those days to travel. And he traveled for 10 years. So the covet of Shluch Eretz Yisrael was something that he was very concerned about. It was something that bothered him, the way people mistreated. He felt some of it was the fault of the Shluchim Eretz Yisrael themselves. He said that some of the Shluchim from Eretz Yisrael, they would say, I'm not taking less than $1,000 or whatever, you know, the equivalent kind of money. And then at the end, they would be happy with $25. And it made people feel that the whole thing is a joke. On the other hand, he felt some of the Shluchim would bear down very hard on people that were not capable of giving and force them to give money. And he felt that was also an avla. Very, very, it was not a simple matzav. He spent 5 years collecting money. He kept exact cheshbonos, we have it, of all the expenses that he laid out. And certain things, he was extremely careful with the money. On the other things, he wouldn't compromise. He said he felt that the covet of a Shliach Hatzol needs to be kept. He refused to ride in anything other than a carriage. He wanted to be dressed, he carried a lot of clothing with him to always be dressed clean and neat and so on and so forth. Wherever he went, he looked, like I told you, the first thing he went to look for Sfarim and Kisvi Yadis. And he kept this, his 40 years worth of notes. His Margal Toiv spans 40 years. And he writes every single thing like that. He found this, and went through this, and it was Mizgala to me, this and this and that and that and the other thing. He had a tremendous chush for it. And this was a first order of business wherever he went. He also would be involved in being mochiach people. He would find in every community what he felt would need, and we have a record of it. In some places he felt people were very, they were lax, they started shaving with razors. In 1700s, people started shaving with razors. People were into philosophy and chacham chitzonis and no out of Torah. All sorts of things in every community he felt. Family life was corrupt in a lot of places, and he would be mochiach, and he would speak about it. He had an eye for it, and would write in every place what he found wanting and lacking, what he spoke about. He himself knew he could speak quite a few languages. He could speak French, he could speak Italian. He picked it up, and he was conversing with people. He also was very beautiful, and he made tremendous roshim. He was very regal, very clean, very neat. Really, really regal, and people very spoil from him. He was very diplomatic, and he writes, in Italy, there was a very wealthy family that were fighting with each other. They had spent 30,000, I don't remember what the coin was, in legal fees fighting each other, and a half a dozen cardinals and the Pope had tried to make shalom with the family, and they weren't matzliach. And he got involved, and he made shalom. And a few places like that where, and in Italy, it's funny, people don't realize, Italy was always a very, what's the right word for it? Very worldly country, and people were very scholarly. They were also a little bit lax on frumkeit. It went hand in hand. Italy was, that was Italy. And the cardinals and the Pope were involved in the Jewish community. It was like government officials, because in those days, the secular and the religious were very intermingled. It was Hainu Hach in some places. So the Pope got involved in the Shalom Bayis of two wealthy families. It was not unheard of. He writes that he would speak. He wrote he came from one place, and a whole bunch of of church officials came to speak to him and ask him shailas in Yiddishkeit and Kabbalah and this and that, and they were very taken by him. They asked him to be mispalel for them and bought him gifts and so on and so forth. He also was, he had an extraordinary eye and interest in everything around him. And he describes in every place big that he went to, the museums that he visited, he writes that they took him to the palace of the King of France. They were very impressed with him. And he writes the paintings, the statues, the displays. He was very taken by it. He describes it. He writes about in the king, he actually met the King of France, like he went by, and the King of France turned to somebody and said, which country does this man represent? He's extremely noble in his bearing. The king was very impressed by him. He was in museums, and he would write that he was very impressed. He saw mummies, he saw skeletons of animals. He said in England he was in a place that had a statue of every king of England, and he comments on it, how lifelike it was, books that they have, all sorts of stuffed animals, exotic plants, in many places, very royal palaces and columns, and he writes about everything, and he's very taken by things, beauty and things that are very royal. His sefer is full of it. He also writes some criticisms about communities that were more primitive. He writes about Tunisia. He was stuck in Tunisia for a while. He writes that they treat him very well. He said he had to say a shir. He said they only learned Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos, and Marsha. That was the only things they learned there. And it was a very different style than he was used to. And he said, you know, they also had a minhag to ask in the middle of the shir, which he wasn't used to. But Baruch Hashem, he held his own, and they respected him, and he says, except that they were very primitive, and they ate with their hands, and it very disgusted him. They everything was filthy, you know, the food was lavish, but it was not clean, and it was an istness, and it bothered him. But he was very appreciative of the attention they gave him. He writes another note that's fascinating about the people in Tunisia and their mindset, mentality, and so on. He was in Tunisia, and he got a letter that his wife passed away. His first wife passed away. And he said, I couldn't tell anybody because they would immediately force me to marry somebody from the community. And he said, and not only, you know, it wasn't the pressure community, they would get the king also involved. So he said, I had to be Misabel Yochid. And he said what he did was he needed to pour his heart out, and he had nobody to pour it out. So he by Tikkun Chatzos, he would sit and think about his wife, and he writes about her, and you know, that she was a Chad B'dora, and he said maybe many Doras, and a Chachma, and a Yoifi, and everything about her, and a Ches, and so on. But he writes the people there were so primitive, they said they would have just rammed the wife down his throat. And he couldn't get out of it, and he had to. And he said for many days, so Tikkun Chatzos, he would sit and sob, thinking about his wife. He writes about the kehillas. He was asked to pass in shailas in different kehillas. He sometimes they looked up to him as a pesik, and sometimes there was makeach with him. Really, really incredible volume of different inyanim that he went through. And he writes about everything. He writes about Paris. On the one hand, he was impressed by its beauty and its splendor. Like we said, he went to a museum. On the other hand, he writes that, he said, Znus over there is beheta, and there are 20,000 registered Zionists as official Zionists. That was Paris. And it's like, it's astounding to him, you know, that something could be so depraved, that this is the matzah of that society. He was he went to almost every part of Europe. He was in Italy all over. He was by the Pnei Yeshua, and Pnei Yeshua was very taken by him. He was very taken by Pnei Yeshua. He was in Italy. He was in Germany. In Germany, in those days, was divided into many little countries. It was very difficult. Every time you pass from one county to another, you had to pay taxes, you had to bribe. It was very difficult, and they got a very difficult reception there. He was in France, he was in England, He was in all parts, many parts of Europe. Fascinating note, he writes very warmly in a few places about the Chassidim. He writes in a few places, Shem HaGdolim, about Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, that Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov was a Kaddish, and someone said over something from him, and writes that the Arachayim was Nofetz because of Baal Shem Tov had his Chassidim learn it. He writes about the Toldus. He doesn't write anything about the Vilna Goyen. Nothing. Very unclear why. The truth is, he did not write about people that were living Bishaitoi, but it does mention Baal Shem Tov maybe was already dead. He does write about the Toldus. It's strange that he doesn't write. We don't know. We have no idea why. He writes in a few places, the Chassidish type of Torah seemed to resonate with him. And he writes in the two or three places, very, very appreciative about things that he saw in the Maranayim, he saw here. That's a story. The Maranayim, he didn't write about that, but it's written in places reliable that he liked the Sefer Latin. He wished he could have met the person who wrote it. His own drush follows a very, very a pattern of similar. It's like he takes a pasuk and he darshens it in a way where he puts a musa into it, in derech drush into the pasuk. That's a very normal style of his, a Sephardi style, and in ways that was a lot more noted to what Chassidus. He doesn't go into philosophy, doesn't like philosophy, doesn't, you know, it's not his thing. Kabbalah, it's interesting. He was a big mekubal. He did not like people learn Kabbalah. In Tunisia, he said, you know, people who he felt were not a madrei came to him and asked him about Kabbalah. Like the nichbadei ha'eda, who he felt were not great nichbadim, asked him about Kabbalah. So he said, I told them, I don't have Kabbalahs with me. I guess it was sort of a double lashon where they would understand to mean that he doesn't know Kabbalah, but he meant something else. So it wasn't a lie, but he was able to get out of it. He said, but once one of the heads of the Eda said a drasha, and he took a shtickle, a rizal, and said it on his own name. So he got very angry and he said, it's an arizal. You simply plagiarized an arizal and just said it over. And the person said, hey, I thought you don't know Kabbalah. So he told him, this arizal is brought in the following safe in this place. That was he didn't, and it's interesting, he didn't write, a lot of his firm have sort of things taken from Arizal, especially in Shem HaGdolim. He constantly quotes Reb Chaim Vital. In different places he writes, which was the Kabbalah Mitis, which is not Kabbalah Mitis. He himself didn't write on Kabbalah, so that we don't have on Kabbalah. Al Kapanim, to sum up, I guess, he was, I guess, one of the most incredible Isha Shkoilos Kleisel had. Very, very rarely is a person kolel such extremes in him. He was a big tzaddik. He fasted Tanesim, was Mesagiv himself. We have many, many Kabbalahs of his on himself. Not to do this, not to this, that. He wrote, so there are some tefillahs we have from him that made it into the Siddur. The famous one is by Tashlich. He wrote two or three Sfarim, Avodas HaKodesh and the Tzipor and Shamir and others, where he has like little tefillahs and yirotzins to say in different occasions. He did do that. He rarely did Klai Yisrael have a person that was kolel so much in one person. His appearance was malchus. He wrote prolifically, and again, like every Mikzayan Torah has a fuse form of his. He was he spoke beautifully in many, every place asked the way he came would ask him to speak again and again and so on and so forth. He restored some of the kavod to the Shluch Eretz Yisrael. It really, really was difficult because they, you know, who do you send out for 5 years to Chutz La'aretz in dangerous circumstance? You send out the Gadol Ha'ida, or do you send out the person that's willing to do it, or the person that's out to do it? It wasn't Pashit. you know, you want to send out the person who was most chashim. He did go, and he brought tremendous kavod for the Shluch Eretz Yisrael. His descriptions of the communities and their problems and what life was like is invaluable. You through the eyes of a big person who's not, doesn't seem to be pulling any punches, describes in full detail hundreds and hundreds of communities all over Europe, their milas, their chesroinus, their in every way possible, life in general in Europe. He writes a lot about different things, wars that were going on, and governments. He writes about America. He was not in America, but he writes a lot about America and so on, things that are there that he's heard and seen and so on. And for us, the most important is, in Shema Gdolim, it's interesting, his first sefer that he ever wrote as a young person, I think it was called Helmdav, if I'm not mistaken, was a sefer that is different in Yanim that no one's written about, because they did not have Kisvi Yadis, they were missing information and things like that. And he was the first and most reliable person to put together a bibliography, to put together a list, to put together a sense of who learned by whom, who came where, what are the Sfarim that we have, where did it come from. He corrects mistaken, you know, there were all sorts of Sfarim that were attributed, mistaken attributions he corrects. In the Sfarim, he shows how, by if you learn a sefer well, you can glean much from it. Who was this Rebbe, where did it come from, what was it written, what was the context, which sefer was written before what sefer. Incredible, it's incredible work in a small thing. And for us, that seems to be the great contribution to history. And he was, by many, especially by his father, he was considered to be the Gadol of the Dor. He was somebody who's, he was above the fray. He was a great, he was a big politician in the sense that he got along with people. And even when he had to be mochiach, he writes, ishtamashti, he uses the word politics the way we would say diplomacy. He said, I needed to be mochiach, but I did it with a lot of politica, which means, you know, to do it with a diplomacy. And his yard side is Yeral Avadah. He, in Eretz Yisrael, you know, he was one of the cornerstones of the future Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And for us, we have the legacy of the Shema Gdolim, which is today, it's you don't even realize that it's the basis for Kamat. Everything we know about the histories of those middle tkufas.
We have to go.
Okay. Okay, you. Okay. What? Yeah, he traveled himself.
He had children.
Yes, yeah, he left over children.
And he had another wife also?
He got married a second time. Not sure.
Did he collect crazy amount of money from all that time, or did he use it from a different
route? I'm not sure. He seemed to have collected a lot of money for Erdor. He was very, very successful in fundraising. The numbers we have, we know it seems to be a very big success.
So because of him, the yeshivas kept him going and stuff?
It was more than the yeshivas. The yeshiva itself, they were taxed out of their wits. Mm. You know, it was every time the Turk needed money, they taxed them with this tax, that tax, the other tax. It was a crazy amount of, you know, it was things that were not normal in terms of... He writes that there's a Maseiris that Azulai, he writes in his sefer, his great grandfather's Avrom Azulai, he writes that there was a Maseiris that they were Kahanim, and it's Rosh HaTevish, Isha Zoyna Grucha Lo Yikachu. But then somebody put a Chayim, anybody that would say that. I don't know the politics of that. I don't know the.
It comes from somewhere substantial.
He writes himself, Hashem HaGdolim, on the Avraham Azulai, on his grandfather, he writes that thing. And then he writes something about along the lines that he put a chayim on it. I don't know what the pshat there was.
Mm.
He's buried it. It's interesting. He's buried in Italy, but they reburied him in Haram Nuchas. So you can find him at Haram Nuchas, Har Zeisim. It's in Haram Nuchas. They reburied him in Haram Nuchas. They unearthed him from Livorno.
Recently?
Not recently, meaning 50 years ago, 60 years ago, really? That type.
Was that his wish, or was...
He always wished to be an Eretz Yisrael. I'm not aware that
it
was
dangerous to like move the dome amongst the buried.
So if they asked Mechila, if there was a threat on the cave, I don't know. I don't remember exactly. But he was moved. The Alter Nevardik was reburied in Yerushalayim. Who else? The I don't know. The Goyim is not buried in Yerushalayim. The Goyim was moved. He was reburied, but then I. The Welt says that the people who reburied him died.
Right.
It's not true.
Not true?
No. Rabbi Lyman's father knew the people. He actually did research on it. But I heard another part that some of the people who reburied him tried to look at him. But you can ask Rabbi Lyman's. Rabbi Lyman's father has a tape on it. He actually managed to interview some of the people who did it. Years afterwards, they appeared in newspapers. It's not true that it was that they died all. But
they left.
How do you close this thing? Anyone have an idea? What this is going to the top?
The place was called the Schnippischock.
Schnippischock is Schnippischock was a little.
They
slow recording. So maybe the home button. I don't know.